Hello there and welcome along to this week's edition of The Front Page, the Racing Post show where we get our teeth stuck into the biggest and best stories of the past week. This week I'm your host Maddie Plell and we have scoured near and far for the Racing Post best. I'm joined by our West Country correspondent James Stevens in the studio and we have our France correspondent Scott Burton on the line as well, who's just about dried out from Longchamps yesterday. James, lots to discuss this week. Can't wait to get stuck into it. What have you been up to though? Anything to report?
It's been busy enough. It's a quiet part of the season now for me in the Southwest. Just about got over the jump season. And it's quite enough. We had some bit of news with Jane Williams in her yard being in a bit of a doldrums with a rapeseed oil crop, which was quite strange and bizarre. So there's always stuff going on in the off-season. It seems like everyone's taken out a dual licence at the minute. You've got the early start of the jump season and who's jostling for the conditional titles and stuff. So the jump season's busy, but yeah, I must admit, I'll say it without being caught, but I have quite enjoyed the start of a flat season as well.
Keep it quiet. You might upset people. And Scott, what about you? I mentioned the weather was pretty awful at Longchamp yesterday, but some great performances on track, and we're going to get stuck into the classic clues shortly.
Yeah, no, it has also been a tale of two halves because I was in Deauville for 2 days before that for the Breeze Up sale, where it was absolutely blazing sunshine and everybody wanted to spend time on the beach rather than in the sales ring. And then, as you say, to Longchamp yesterday, where the French 1000 Guineas was run on rattling fast ground in sunshine, and then 35 minutes later they were sending the colts back to the saddling boxes because we had hailstones and torrential rain and the threat of thunder and lightning. So yes, it's all been a bit strange.
So plenty to discuss on today's show. We've got the classic trials, of course, a busy week at Chester, Lingfield and Leopardstown yesterday with some movements in the classic markets for the Derby and the Oaks. We're going to get stuck in to those and see which the guys think have their best credentials for those Epsom Classics. And then it's been an eventful week on track for both horses and riders. James is going to discuss a little bit more about what's been going on and what you might have missed there and just some of the risks that these jockeys take week in, week out and how important that is. But first, our exclusive story, exclusive in Sunday's paper by Lee Mottershead. He always finds a way to get onto this show, even when he's not on the panel, is British Racing's radical plan for its biggest flat events. So this was, as I say, exclusive in Sunday's paper, and it's going to be potentially transformative for British Racing. It's all about how British Racing's leaders are going to consider combining flat racing's biggest events into a single commercial entity. Now, we've seen this happen in other previous instances with different sports, and basically it would require racecourses to cede control of their most valuable assets to an international private equity or a sovereign wealth fund. Now, this ties in well with the concept of premierisation, of course, the trial which will come to a close in 2026. And there's different pieces of work being undertaken in preparation for that. The industry's commercial committee have agreed to launch a tender process whose chosen candidate will be asked to assess the merits of pulling up to 40 meetings of flat racing's best, and then to source global partners who may be interested in investing in the business. And then a second tender document, which is hoped will be the sport's most comprehensive piece of consumer research, is set to then be completed in the autumn. All of this stemming from a PwC report commissioned last year by the Thoroughbred Group. And as I say, this is racing exploring an avenue which has previously been taken by the likes of Newcastle United. It's 80% owned by the Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund. And it's also come into play in rugby union and the Women's Tennis Association as well. So could this be a new dawn for British flat racing? Is it an exciting new venture, or is it never going to get off the ground? Let's see what this is going to mean for our sport and what our panellists think of it. James, first off, I know it's an idea that you're not particularly keen on. Tell us why, but first off, is there some positives to be taken from the fact that racing is exploring new avenues?
Well, I don't think you can ever criticise the concept of looking at an issue, identifying a problem and trying to find different ways to solve it than haven't been explored before. So there's never any harm in thinking about different ideas. There were two elements to this, the second of which was led by data-driven report, lots of consumer research. I'm working on a piece about sponsorship at the minute, and one of the things that a lot of racecourses have said is that their businesses just absolutely, the absolutely fundamental thing is consumer research. So knowing what the audience wants, knowing how to interact with them. So the fact that there's such a big project being done there is great. In terms of this commercial stuff, I'm first and foremost, I don't think it's going to happen. I think I'm still scarred from my time working through COVID and looking at how racing was having to evolve and change and work together, and it just seemed impossible. And the sport coming together to solve something almost never happens. In terms of this deal, I'm massively against it. I feel it's almost like horse racing's Super League moment, whereby it didn't perhaps get the same social media uproar as the football one did, because I think people were aware it's still very early days. Tender process is the words Lee used, and I think it is unlikely to happen. I mean, it is a business sense that you sell the crown jewels, which is like your last ditch strategy. That's what business people say. I looked up on the train this morning. And to me, it's just a complete and utter surrender of incompetence in that Premier Racing isn't working. We can't get people through the door. So let's sell it and make a bit of money and see if that works. Well, it's probably not. And actually, when you dig deep and think what British flat racing has got, it's got the Derby, Royal Ascot, the Guineas, the King George, the St. Ledger, these races which not just in Britain are huge or British culture huge, but in world sport, those are huge names. All the other jurisdictions, a lot of it is taken from how we started, that fundamental platform that we created the sport with in Great Britain. And it's almost really sad that we have to look at ways to sell it, and we can't promote it within ourselves. So I think that is the thing I take from this, is that it shouldn't be about packaging it up, sort of selling it and letting someone else do what they want for it. Because the reason it is so successful and what draws people to Britain and why people all over the world look at Royal Ascot is because for years and years and years, it has always been done in a certain way. And people like that. It's tradition. It carries a lot of weight. And I think it would be a huge shame if we let somebody pay money to tinker with it and change it and take some of the things that makes it so popular, not just globally, but internationally, but locally as well. People like the meetings, people like going to the Derby, to Royal Ascot. When you start changing it, it opens up a whole lot of things. So I'm very cautious, because for all on the front, it might seem like a good idea. Giving someone that power allows them to change it, and that might not be the direction we want it to go in.
Okay, in the piece it was referenced that industry insiders were saying this was highly improbable, that the likes of Ascot, the Jockey Club, etc. would give up their control over these fixtures. I guess the thinking is racing trapped by the way it's structured? And if so, is this the only viable thing that can be done? What do you think will have to happen in order for them to give up that control?
Well, I think they'll all have to agree that the sport is in such a dismal way that they need urgent action. This is absolutely last ditch. It has to be. I mean, to give someone that power. I mean, there's a lot of talk about it at the snooker at the minute. The idea that the Crucible could be the Crucible will no longer hold the Snooker World Championship, which is a huge thing, and it would go abroad and be watched by that. And that in that sport, it just really. The mood in snooker about that move is just so negative. It's like this is the big thing, and to lose it would take so much away from the whole of the sport. And what racing does have, as for all it has its problems, and there are all the different issues that we talk about in this show, the actual product is still pretty special. I mean, I was looking through all the flat races. If you think about where you would find the races you most want to win in certain divisions, only really the Foray and the Arc and dirt races are ones that aren't held in their respective divisions away from Britain. So in terms of the product we have, it's absolutely fantastic. We've got a summer of jumping all across the country. Our racetracks are completely unique. You've got different racetracks. Some of them are really scenic and beautiful. And to suddenly just look at that and say, you know what, let's just look elsewhere and try and give a bit of that away. It just sells some of the colour of it. This sport and what British flat racing has got is pretty exceptional. It just needs to package itself and market itself to really hit home with the British public, to get people back racing, which for many, many years they did. And it's just that in a competitive sporting world, it's not quite what it once was. But with the right management, with this consumer-led research, understanding what people want, the data, let the data drive, there's still a way that this sport will absolutely prosper without needing to give someone else that power.
Okay, money talks, doesn't it, Scott? And Julie Harrington was saying that if there is enough of it and interest by these potential investors, then it could be transformative for some of British flat racing's biggest events. Do you think this is the solution to the industry's ills?
I can't say if anybody knows whether it's the solution at the moment, but I think there's almost a dereliction of duty in not exploring it, because as Lee referenced in the piece, many other sports are doing this. I mean, as James said, even football, the great financial engine that is football, explored a way of making all the clubs even more rich with the European Super League. The most obvious comparison close to home would be the Six Nations Rugby, where there is private finance that bought a part of the equity in that, and now there's essentially, it's like a Seven Nations Championship, if you like, with a company that now has invested considerably in the tournament. There hasn't been any obvious change to the tournament structure as such. We're not suddenly playing matches at 3 a.m. to suit a different television market or anything like that. But you imagine that those investors do want to have some say in the future developments of it, whatever that might be, whether it's inviting other countries in or having promotion or relegation or changing the point structure or what time of year it's played, any of those sorts of things. And I suppose that's the question that British Racing's kind of major shareholders have to say, is if a potential investor, a sovereign wealth fund or a private equity firm shows some interest in it, what kind of control would they have to cede? It's maybe we shouldn't pick out individual courses or individual race course groups, but clearly Ascot stages some of the most significant racing in any potential package like that. And even in comparison to something like the King George, Royal Ascot is so unique and so different, and is such a diplomatically delicate event, because obviously everything is negotiated with the palace, with the royal family. They have actually been quite clever in recent years. There is quite a lot more commercial activity around Royal Ascot. It's just very well camouflaged. There's official insurance partnerships and official timings and all the rest of it. And there are holdings at Royal Ascot if you know where to look for them. A little bit the same way that Wimbledon tennis have done it. It's kind of all done very tastefully and in muted colours. But there is money around Ascot during Royal Ascot, the 5 days of the meeting. So I think in some senses that would be the biggest hurdle to it, because any package that doesn't involve those 5 days is probably dead in the water. But I think if you look at the way that you mentioned Newcastle United, Six Nations, a good example of what happens when you don't explore these kinds of options is what's happening in professional golf, which is an absolute car crash at the moment. You have the private investment fund, obviously were not welcomed with open arms by the US PGA Tour, so set up a rival tour, in the case of LIV Golf. And then there's now been, since last June, endless negotiations to try and see if the two sides can come together and have some co-sanctioned events, or whether those players who were basically bought off of the PGA Tour, including the then world number one, John Rahm, went off to go and play for this rival Saudi tour, if whether there can be some sort of coming together between them. That is a complete mess. And if you think horse racing has got a bizarre power structure, then nothing on the PGA Tour happens without say-so of about five players who will sit on the players' board. And if Tiger Woods and Jordan Spieth say no to something, then it doesn't happen. The commissioner of the entire sport hasn't got the power to override what several of the really key players say. So from that point of view, horse racing may have a strange power structure in Britain, but it's by no means the strangest out there. And I just think that whilst a deal might be difficult to do and there are a lot of competing interests, I think it's beholden on Julie Harrington and those people at the BHA, the Jockey Club, Royal Ascot, to at least explore it, because we keep looking for this step change that will try and turbocharge the finances of British flat racing. Maddie, you've been racing all over the world, Dubai, Japan, Hong Kong. These places have got so much more in terms of prize money and in terms of things that will entice people to own horses than is available in Britain. And we talk about levy reform, we talk about premierisation, but this, something that could really inject a category change amount of money into the sport, I think you at least have to give it house room in your head and explore it.
Indeed. And James mentioned the promotion of racing and how racing really needs to step up and sell the sport. Maybe this could be the answer to that. Do you think realistically it's something that could get off the ground, given the structures in place and the likely conversations that are going to be had? How realistic do you think it is?
I think anything that could increase the promotional budget for racing has to be welcomed. I mean, Great British Racing, I think, you know, there's fair criticism to be made of some of the projects that they've steered, but they have done remarkably well in terms of delivering anything in terms of bang for what is a very small buck. And I think anything that can increase the amount of money that can be spent to just put horse racing as an option for people's leisure time in front of their eyes. I mean, even like a relatively small national advertising campaign on radio, something which sounds like it should be just a basic starter, would cost far more than the current system has got to spend on it, you know, in terms of actually, you know, they always say in politics that you have to drum the message home so often that those of you who are actually promoting the message are almost sick of hearing it before anybody really understands it and it actually gets through to them. And I just think, you know, so many people that I know, if you take them horse racing, they have a fantastic time and they think, well, why didn't I think of doing this before? And they just don't know it's out there as an option to do it. And I think the kind of resources that are required to actually really present the sport to the wider public just requires quite a lot of extra money. And we know that prize money is an issue. We know that governance is an issue. Everything costs money these days. And I just think that we have to at least explore ways of trying to get extra money into the sport.
Okay, James, so a bit of balance there from Scott, I think it's fair to say. Can always rely on him for that. Give you right of reply, I guess. What would you like to see? You're not a big fan of this idea of there being sort of a commercialisation of flat racing's biggest events. So what would you like to see? What's the alternatives?
Well, no, and one more point actually on that is I think that we talk about golf, we talk a bit about football and stuff, and I think that one of the key things with what's happened in those sports is that there's been this drive about bringing new people in, new fans of a sport in, and actually the people who are neglected are actually the real true fans of a sport. And I think often there are decisions made in this sport which perhaps sometimes forgets the racing's core audience, the people who do already enjoy the sport and like various elements of it. And maybe that they're always people that are just a little bit forgotten about in the wider context of getting new people in, which is, of course, massively important. Premier Racing has been a huge disappointment. There's no two ways about it. But the budget hasn't been there for it. It was described in December as hopelessly inadequate. Great British Racing have a budget of £2 million. About £1 million of which has been spent on Premier Racing or various parts of that process. In context, the 100, which was the big cricket series, when it launched, they had £40 million, and I think they've got a lot more. I can't find the numbers as to how much it, but it's significantly more than 40 minutes to promote that sport. And I think it's very difficult because it's like, well, Premier Racing hasn't been a success. It's been loosely mentioned with a bit of signage and a nice logo. Obviously the Premier Race days have come in and the prize money levels are good, but in terms of actually going out and about, one of the main objectives of going out and as Scott mentions, really finding it with people and getting people to come racing, the money's not there, so the results haven't been there. So the whole sort of idea of a trial behind this is almost a wasted opportunity because the money and the investment's not been in it, so you don't know what the results would have been. It basically has been a waste of time because the money's not been there. The project, the trial hasn't been done fully, so you can't say it. Look, I think what needs to be done is this data stuff is huge. That's the main thing for me. I think the idea of selling rights, yeah, look, it's good to explore things. It's good to see what the value is and to learn a bit more.
Tells you how desirable racing is.
It certainly
ultimately does,
and it would be a bit of a confidence boost for what we are selling, I guess. But I think that has to be seen as the last resort. We've got enough quality win. There's a lot of good people in this sport that can guide it through, market the sport. And as Scott says, racing is a fantastic day out. It is just literally a case of resonating it with people and going, look, there's all this great stuff going on in the summer. You can bring your kids for free. It's not too expensive if you get the right deals and it's priced right. Have a good day out and people will come back. It's as simple as that.
James has summed it up nicely for us there then. If you missed out on that Sunday exclusive on the front page of the Racing Post, just remember it's one of the excellent benefits you can get through our Members Club subscription. There's also that premierisation special report from Lee Mottishead as well. Check out our Members Club offer here.
Get 50% off your first 3 months in the Racing Post Members Club. As a member, you get access to the digital newspaper exclusively available to members the night before. You'll get daily tips on the likes of Pricewise, Tom Siegel, Robbie Wilders and Paul Keighley. Enjoy award-winning journalism from the industry's best writers and watch replays from all British and Irish racing now available within the Racing Post app. Subscribe today and get 50% off your first 3 months membership.
Welcome back to the front page, and it's time to dig into some of the performances of last week. Now, there's been plenty of movers and shakers in the Derby market. All started off on a rather somber note, though, at Chester in the Chester Vars, when sadly Hidden Law, who was in the process of putting up a hugely exciting performance, sadly suffered a fatal injury after the line. He looked a colt of real potential, and our thoughts are with Charlie Appleby and his team with the loss of Hidden Law, because that certainly would have catapulted him towards the top of the Derby lists. We also had Capulet winning the D Stakes for Aidan O'Brien and Ryan Moore. Ambient Friendly for James Fanshawe and Callum Shepherd firmly put his hat into the ring in the Lingfield Derby trial on Saturday. That race produced the winner in Anthony van Dyck not so long ago now. Can this horse do the same? He was a wide margin winner. And then also at Leopardstown on Sunday, we had the Group 1 winner Los Angeles returning with a gritty performance in that Group 3 Derby trial. So let's see who impressed our panellists the most. James, obviously a couple of really eye-catching performances. Hidden Law, just incredibly sad. He was my early selection for the Derby. What do you make of the market now? Let's just run through them. So City of Troy and Arabian Crown towards the top at fours. Los Angeles and Ambient Friendly at tens. Ancient Wisdom, 11s. Diego Velasquez, 16s. Capulet, 20s. And Bigger the Remainder. Who's caught your eye?
So I'm not convinced I've seen the Derby winner yet. So there were times when I used to watch the trials and think, you know what, I've probably seen it. I thought Ambient Friendly was very, very impressive. And the performance, I think it's the sort of horse that I think if it was a 2-1 favourite for Aidan O'Brien, this would have immediately gone favourite, because it was a serious performance. Almost a textbook way to win a middle distance race. Travelled well throughout, quickened well. And look, he's clearly a very, very good horse. And exciting for all connections. It's nice to see James Fanshawe and Callum Shepherd go to the Derby with a leading hope. Great.
Absolutely.
Great to see. The one that caught my eye, I thought, from an each way perspective, is Illinois, who has this very awkward way of racing and is not the most straightforward. And I just wonder whether there's a little bit more from him to come. He's a really interesting horse. The only other horse I took out from the meeting was Grosvenor Square in the Vars, was third. Beaten favourites, a little bit disappointing. But I saw him in the paddock and thought, my word, I wouldn't really want to be backing this horse around Chessie. He's a big sort of horse. And I looked at him and last night and saw 20-1 for the St. Ledger. I think he's a proper stayer in the making. I don't think he's a Derby horse. So they were the two horses I took out. But I always like the Dante. That's always the race I go back to. So I think this week we're ready to see a real standout. City of Troy is the interesting one. That's the one I just keep looking at and going, what on earth is going to happen? I mean, last year I was just all Augustus Rodin, that's not going to win. That was rubbish in the Guineas. But you just keep going back to him and the form of last season and the horses he's beaten, and they've done this, and the horses behind him have done this and that. And he had that seriously special reputation. He was sent off odds on the Guineas compared to Frankel. And I just wonder whether we'll all be sat in here in a few weeks' time going, 4-1 for the Derby. Why do we ever doubt him? But I think Illinois each way is the bet for me at this stage.
And it's interesting you've mentioned several Aidan O'Brien trained horses. It's been a funny couple of weeks for the yard, hasn't it? Very hit and miss.
Yeah.
His horses coming on for the run seemingly a lot. Do you think there's been a change in approach at Ballydoyle into how they condition these classic horses?
I don't know. I wouldn't be 100% sure either way where we'll look at that. I mean, I thought the interesting one, as you say, Cameron, was Capulet, who was beaten in the Kentucky Derby trial race at Chelmsford and then improved for the D-Stakes. So I think sometimes you do just get seasons where horses from a certain yard improve for their first run. And I don't know if it's necessarily a change of anything. I wouldn't know the yard too well, but there are just every so often a year will do that. Particularly big stables, just one year, they will just sometimes come on more for their first run than they may do others. It's interesting to watch, but I wouldn't rely on that being the case for years and years to come.
OK, let's see what Scott thinks. Scott, which of the colts has really taken your eye for the Derby?
I'm not sure. Like James, I have a Derby horse yet. Talking about the way that Aidan's season has gone so far, I think, as you say, he traditionally always leaves something to work on with the first run. And for years with his Guineas winners, he if you like, got away with it. And then they were able to kind of like a Camelot to win the 2000 Guineas on class and then go and win the Derby when they were fully tuned up. I think the problem he's had this year is it's been such a wet spring. And wherever the rest of us may live, Paris or London or wherever, I imagine it's been absolutely dreep in Tipperary. So I think possibly that way of kind of gradually winding them up and then having them come on, I think has been problematic for him this year. It's been problematic for every racehorse trainer, but I think a lot of them have looked like they needed the run. So from that point of view, I really actually was quite impressed with Los Angeles yesterday. He's actually one of Aidan's that I've seen in the flesh because he won at St. Cloud last back end, beat a horse of Joseph O'Brien's called Islands in the Stream, who's since been sold to Hong Kong. He's, again, a little bit like Grosvenor Square, a big unit, big heavy-shouldered horse, who you would have thought, given the way some of Aidan's have run, would have needed the run and would definitely come on for it. So the fact that he's actually managed to win, I think spoke well for him. As I say, he's a very sort of striking individual. I thought Capulet did nothing wrong in winning the D Stakes as well. But it has been a year when, certainly in the mile classics, the result of the trials has been totally turned on its head when we've actually got to the classics themselves. If you looked at, obviously, at the 1,000 Guineas, Elmalka was third in her trial. The two French classics yesterday, the winner of the Phillies Classic, Riviera, was third in her trial. Metropolitan was fifth of six in his trial. So I think possibly you might end up looking at some of the beaten horses and think, well, maybe there is something there. I mean, Agenda obviously was well beaten by poor old Hidden Law. I'm just about old enough to remember a colt of Sir Michael Stout's, or then Michael Stout's, called Miller's Mate, who won the Wood Ditton and went to the Chester Vars with an enormous reputation and he was virtually favourite for the Derby before he even ran the Wood Ditton. And he suffered an injury during the Vars. And fortunately, they were able to save him. But the horse that beat him, Law Society, then went on to be second in the Derby behind Slip Anchor. So it might be one of those years where you don't want to chuck out everything that finishes behind the trial winners because, as I say, especially with a perspective that some of these horses are going to come on a lot for their run. The Dante, obviously, is going to be crucial as well. There was a couple of bits of form over the weekend that probably... showed that Ancient Wisdom won a particularly good, although it was terrible ground at the end of last year, the Futurity was probably quite a good race. Dancing Gemini, who didn't really cope with the ground at Doncaster last year, ran an absolute screamer in the French 2000 yesterday. And Diego Velasquez, who also didn't really cope with the ground at Doncaster, he ran on very, very well for fourth, and he's got form with Capulet as well. If they decided to step him up to a mile and a half, Diego Velasquez would probably carry a bit of each way money for me. But Los Angeles would be tentatively the one at the moment.
Both of those shape like incredibly strong stayers, don't they? And Scott, given this is your story, I will hand over to you now to talk about the fillies. There were some good performances from the likes of Forest Fairy, You Got To Me, and the runner-up at Lingfield as well.
Yeah, Forest Fairy I like a lot. She went in the tracker when she won at Wolverhampton by six lengths on debut. And, the Derby and the Oaks for so many years have been Galileo's race, and obviously we no longer have Galileo now, but Voltgeist obviously is a horse that I followed. He was trained here in France, won the Arc for André Farb and Gestut Ammerland, and Forest Fairy is a very, very she travelled really, really well during the Cheshire Oaks, and it took quite a long time for Ross Orion to find the gap. And she kind of did it pretty, she really only had a furlong to work with. And although she wasn't very far ahead of Port Fairy at the line, I thought she did it very, very well. And, you know, there are not that many trainers you look for outside of John Gosden, Charlie Appleby and Aidan O'Brien when it comes to the Epsom Classics. But Rafe Beckett is definitely one. And he obviously won the Linkfield trial as well. And he's in the past, he's actually won the Oaks with his second string. But I really, really like Forest Fairy. And I think I think she's still about 8-1 or something like that. I think that's a decent bet.
Let's run you through some of those Oaks prices then. Ylang Ylang at 5-2. Friendly sold the Pretty Polly win at 10s. Rubies are Red, who was the runner-up in that Lingfield trial, at 12s with Tam Farna, who was the eye-catcher in the 1,000 guineas. Then Forest Fairy at 14s, Azalea at 14s. You Got to Meet at 16s, and it's 20-1 bar. Scott, just as you're looking over this crop of three-year-olds, what's your instinct on how good they are? And is it a crop that's really igniting your interest as previous years have done? What is it about the classic campaign that you know really sells racing so well, do you think?
I suppose we want an absolute star, and we want, because especially in Britain and Ireland, we put a big premium on two-year-old racing. So an unbeaten Dewhurst winner like City of Troy, is that helps sell flat racing during the winter in a way here that in France probably isn't the case, because plenty of the trainers are kind of Jean-Claude Rouget and André Farb might not run their best horse in a Group One at the end of the season. They might give them a much quieter campaign and then bring them through in a trial at three. But I think that's what we want. And obviously City of Troy didn't put up any kind of a performance at all. Henry Longfellow never really got in the race in the French 2000 yesterday. Don't forget, he was an unbeaten Group One winner as well. And I suppose from that point of view, that's where Los Angeles does come in, because he's still unbeaten. He won a Group One last year, albeit probably one that's not on many British or Irish punters' radar. And he could be the one that is ready to take that step forward. He'll probably still be a price come Derby Day, because Rymar's never ridden him. He's had three runs now, and I think Shaney Heffernan rode him on his debut. Christophe Soumillon rode him at St. Cloud last year. And then obviously Wayne Lorden yesterday. And if City of Troy goes to the Derby, it's inconceivable to me that Ryan Moore won't be riding him. Whether they think he's really stepped up from his 2,000 guineas run or not, he's just such an important horse to them that somebody somewhere, Wayne or Dylan Brown McGonagall, somebody is going to get a very good spare ride on Los Angeles. And it's just, I think, you know, it would be nice to say that after the 2,000 guineas and the 1,000 guineas that we already have a kind of a real flag carrier for the year. But I think it's probably going to be down to the Derby to do it. But there's no better place to find out than Epsom, is there?
There absolutely isn't. Maybe the proof will be in the pudding with the jockey bookings then, Scott seems to suggest, at least for the Derby. James, just before we move on to your story, I want to pose you a question. Kieran Schumach, in a new role with the Gosdens this year, rode a short price fancy Danielle in that Oaks trial. And what have you make of the start that he's made? It hasn't all been plain sailing so far. How do you think the rest of the season's going to go?
No, flat racing is the season just goes so quick. It's rat-a-tat-tat. It's big rides every sort of few weeks, and he hasn't had that big moment yet. But every big jockey, when they have that, they just need a moment to say, right, that was the day, signed, sealed, delivered, great ride from Kieran Schumach. It could come this weekend with Inspiral. That is the sort of ride you're looking at. When a jockey doesn't have a winner, whether it's for a new yard or whether it's they've just run out their claim, there's always a few eyes when they haven't ridden a winner for some time and everyone watches. So the pressure will be on him on Saturday. That's a big opportunity. He's got the shoes of Frankie Dettori to fill, which is not an easy thing to do. But Saturday's a big day. If he wins the lock-in John Inspiral, gets a Group One, all will be well. You just don't want these things hanging over you, because it adds pressure. It gets people like us talking, which is never what jockeys want. They just want to go out their business and ride winners. So Saturday will be a big day. We'll see what happens after that. But I can't go away without speaking about Rubies are Red, who is absolutely my fancy for the Oaks. I was so blown.
Tell us why.
This horse looked completely lost and beaten at Lingfield, and the way she finished that race was absolutely caught my eye. I was so surprised by it. Time was pretty good. She was quicker than Ambient Friendly from 5 furlongs out. Sectionals read well. Wasn't just how she looked visibly. And she just looked like every furlong she was just getting, sort of improving with the whole experience. It was a hell of a run. And in an Oaks where there's a few doubts, I saw her at 10-1. I just think that's an absolute bet because you know she'll stay the trip. Great pedigree, right connections. Aidan O'Brien always seems to win the Oaks, it seems, particularly with his second and third string. It was a race which wasn't particularly... Well, I think it was a great ride from the front from Hector Crouch. I think she was definitely to one take out of the weekend. She's a really nice horse, and 10-1, I think that's a hell of a price.
And there you are then, James Stevens with his Betfred Oaks tip for you. Remember, on the Racing Post website, you've got all the tipping and insight you need to keep up to date with. We're going to move on to our final story of the day now, and that's back over to James. And a poignant one, this, because this week is Mental Health Awareness Week, James. And there's a couple of tangents of stories that you'd like to discuss. Just tell us about your thinking this week.
Yeah, so I think it's important that we remember Mental Health Awareness Week in racing, because there are so many different ways it impacts people, from whether they're participants in the sport to whether they watch it as a fan or spectator, someone who bets on the sport. So it's important just to mark these things. There's a lot of stuff out there for a good reason. And I think we saw this week some of what can happen in the sport. So I was doing a bit of race course reporting this week and saw possibly one of the worst things I've seen on racecourse, which was an incident at Fontwell where Sean Bowen was unseated. And it looked, watching it live, as if the horse behind him had jumped into him. And only then, a couple of seconds later, did the commentator pick it up, and he just walked away as if like nothing had happened, which is absolutely unbelievable how he was okay. The slow motion replays show how close he was to a potentially hugely serious incident. 2 days later, William Easterby, he suffered a really bad injury at Market Raisin for a fall, suspected to break a collarbone, and unfortunately his mark Betty Blue died from the incident, which is extremely sad for all connections. Also at Fontwell, we had Thomasine Eisen, I think that pronouncing that right, stretched off on the same card. Apologies if I fudged the pronunciation there. She had some sort of a pelvis injury, I believe. And then Nick Slatter yesterday looked to have sort of a horse land quite awkwardly with him after a fall at Ludlow. So all these incidents happen on race courses. And I wanted to link it back because we hear a lot all the time. And I hear this constantly from trainers and jockeys saying, we go out about our business, we go about our day job, and we get slated on social media when we have a loser. Because these people have incredible pride. So when they do ride a loser, the last thing you need is to be having a lot of abuse. And I think sometimes when you look at these incidents, it reminds you, I mean, you don't need the reminder, but it just does remind you about the risks they take every single day that sort of sport is what it is. We, of course, had the tragic news about Hinlaw and echo all you said about Charlie Appleby and thoughts of them. This game can be up, this game can be down. And I think on a week like this, where there's so much talk about mental health awareness, it's just worth saying that this whole desperate scene of people getting lots of online abuse, it's just really staggering. And if anyone out there is perhaps watching the show that has potentially done it or knows someone who would, have a word, because there is just absolutely no need for it in the sport anymore. And even this week, I mentioned at the top of the show, Jane Williams, she had a 7-4 shot beaten, and all these problems with the yard because of the next door neighbour growing this crop. She had so much abuse that week from that 7-4 shot getting beat. One of the reasons she said she put in the call to us is because she didn't want her horses to run and to be beaten and then have sort of to deal with that, which is, you shouldn't have to deal with that. You should be able to go about your job without having to care what somebody who will probably never meet you have to say. So hopefully this week there'll be lots of content throughout all the sport, but I think it's just an important point to make because unfortunately it does happen so often.
Absolutely, and it's worth remembering if you're after support, the likes of Racing Welfare, etc., offer that in spades, and there are there people to listen to your concerns and worries. Scott, over to you. Obviously, it's a very important week, this. Just tell us about why you think so and how you've been impacted by this sort of thing.
Well, I think you only have to look at the tragic news from Ireland over the weekend. Last weekend, we lost Michael Byrne at the age of 36, a guy who had a very, very good riding career, mostly actually in Britain with Tim Vaughan. You never really know when people are hurting or struggling. there's obviously been a number of very difficult issues come up with even something like Stefano Cerchi killed on the race course. You think about the people who were close to him, who the way that you have to process these things, and in a lot of cases with the actual sort of more public-facing members of the sport, jockeys and trainers, they have to deal with this kind of thing in the glare of the public as well. And I just think any way that we can all just be a bit kinder to one another, as you say, Racing Welfare do an incredible job, but just to just look out for one another and just, you know, take somebody for a cup of coffee and just check in with them every now and then. I just think anything that anybody can do in any walk of life, but horse racing is particularly difficult environment, because compared to any other sport, you're going to lose an awful lot more often. If you're a jockey kind of coming through the ranks and you have to go out and ride, and you might, if you're not Ryan Moore or William Buick or Harry Cobden or whatever, you're probably, if you win one in 20 races, you're actually having quite a good season. That means you're getting beaten 19 times. And as you say, the trolls at the race course, but specifically the anonymity that social media conveys, I just think it's beholden on all of us. As you say, if you know somebody who engages in that kind of activity on social media, or you even kind of suspect it because of something they've said to you on a race course or in a pub or whatever, then have a word with them. But just for us all to look out for one another a bit more.
It's an incredibly poignant message and a natural and important way to end today's show, I think. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we leave, though, I have to give the honour to who's going to be on this week's front page. And given that it is my first time in the presenting chair, I'm going to give it to myself. And basically, Lee Mottershead.
True Lee Mottershead style,
yeah,
as well.
He's winning even when he's not here. I just think the new proposals about how there could be radical changes to flat racing's biggest events, it's such a new idea for racing anyway, and it's going to open up lots of conversation and lots of avenues there. So I think I'll put that on at top for this week. But thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you again next week. And yeah, good luck with your punting, and enjoy the racing this week.